Welcome to the Wickedly Smart Women podcast, featuring stellar conversations with emerging and established wickedly smart women. Thanks for joining us today as we celebrate women who are committed, care deeply, and have the courage to take action and create conscious change all around the world. Now here's your Wickedly Smart host, Angel B. Hartwell.
Welcome to another episode of the Wickedly Smart Women podcast, where we celebrate wickedly smart women and provide our listeners with a wealth of wisdom, along with immediately actionable steps to be smarter, spunkier, and more successful in their impact and their leadership. This is your host, Angel B. Hartwell, and today we welcome our special guest, Dr. Jenny Nuccio. Jenny is the founder and CEO of Imani Collective, which combines the dual power of a social enterprise together with a nonprofit organization to break the cycle of generational poverty in Kenya. Jenny initially founded Imani Collective as a small sewing training program to empower women in the region. Today, Imani Collective exists to empower hundreds of artisans through dignified work, opportunity, and community. Through its associated brands, including Imani Kids, Sela, and Sukwa, hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Imani Collective provides high-quality, sustainable, and scalable merchandise ranging from swag to home decor, kids' toys, and more. I'm so excited to have you here on the show today. Welcome, Jenny.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here. And you did a great job. Pronunciation.
Excellent. Awesome. Well, I want to begin our time together, Jenny, by asking you what inspired you to go to Africa and to serve in the way that you're serving there, because before we started the recording, you mentioned that you actually have lived there for 13 years. So I'm curious, were you, as a child, did you like watch Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom and say, I'm going to grow up and go there? Or was there some other path that led you to Mother Africa?
Yeah, I think I'm not that story. I have plenty of friends who are like, I always knew I was going to be there. I'm not that. I was born and raised in Texas and was really home buddy for a while. And really the genesis of my story actually started in heartbreak, really, when my parents got divorced when I was a teenager. And with that, I kind of went on this journey of discovering who I am and asking a lot of harder questions. You know, I think when you have things like that in your life and you have very steadiness and constant, and then all of a sudden it kind of changes, you just start to discover new things. And so I actually went to Kenya specifically on a mission trip right out of high school. And when I did, my immediate response to it was, I actually never want to do this again. I started to ask a lot of questions of, why am I needed? Why am I here? This feels really weird, you know, going into a village, feeling very invasive. And then at the same time, being in a 5-star hotel and I have a buffet in front of me, like, what's this kind of conundrum that is in front of me right now? And so at that age, I didn't really actually know what I was processing, but it is the root for why I do what I do now and the start of Imani Collective. And it's really cool to look back and reflect on that and be like, oh, wow, you know, I was asking those questions. And I'm so glad I journaled in that first trip, because when I look back at my journal, all the stuff that I was kind of, you know, asking and wondering and wanting to fight against, but I couldn't put words to it then. So I actually Kenya was the first country I had ever been to outside of the United States. Now I've traveled plenty and I'm very blessed by that, but it really opened my eyes to a lot of things and how we can be unified and be better together if we truly know the questions we need to be asking and if we truly respect and honor the cultures around us.
Beautiful. Well, I love this idea of honoring the culture. And I love that as a young person, relatively young person, that you were able to immediately see and know and feel the dichotomy. And to even be questioning, why am I here? And, you know, I actually took a trip a while back where we were on this trip and we went into this island and we built this playground. And it was like this whole rah, rah, ha, ha, we're building this playground. And I was like, what are we doing? What are we doing? We're building a playground for a school that has 100, 200 kids and there's only 2 swings. This doesn't make any sense to me. So I love that you had that level of consciousness at that age. So like fast forward us a little bit And tell us about the genesis of Amani. Like, what inspired you? Was there time in between that first trip to Kenya and ultimately ending up living there?
Yeah. So I said I would never go back. I think when you say never and you throw that out there, things tend to happen the other way around. We can always laugh at our plans. So yeah, I was like, I'm not needed. I went right into college. And then I went back the following year. Again, for really self-discovery purposes, I feel like in that instance. But I was working with a community building project that was working in the same village from before. And this is where it started, because they gave me a project and they said, hey, we want you to build some child sponsorship programs. Again, had a little bit of differences in how the sponsorship programs were ran, but I was like, okay, I can do this. I can build out stories and I can storytell. So basically every day I would go with these kids and I would walk, you know, maybe a couple meters or miles to their home. And I would sit in their homes, have a cup of chai, and learn about their family, and did that to develop obviously a more robust profile. But what I realized, the commonality between the kids struggling the most, they were coming from these single, widowed, disadvantaged women homes. And the nature of how this sponsorship program was set up is that the actual sponsor, who believed that the kid was being fully sponsored right in school, was actually only being sponsored for like maybe medical aid or their uniform or books, but they still wanted the responsibility of the parents to pay for that school fee. Now, there's a lot of what I agree to in that, but when you have a mother who's never been educated herself, who potentially has 8 kids, who is a widow or has a husband who's a drunkard, that's going to be very hard to provide school fees, even if it's just a couple of dollars. So I went back and I asked them, well, what about the women? Like, what about the root of the cause? Because these kids, after a week, keep getting sent back home. So what about them? And their response was natural. It was like, well, our focus is on this school and this is what we're doing. And I totally respect that, because we can't do all the things. But that was where that light started. And at that time, my 19-year-old self of, am I supposed to do something? Like, what does this look like? And it just started with relationships. I never came at it of like, I have all the solutions. I came at it as, I'm going to be consistent and I'm going to keep showing up in this community and build really strong relationships. And that develops trust and rapport and all of that. And so I did that year after year from 2010, 2011, 2012, and developed really just best friends. I love these women so much. And I asked, well, what can we do? And what do you want to do? And it was in 2012, 2013, where we sat with the chief of the village and said, hey, because also respecting the context they're in, if we started some sort of opportunity like a training program, would, you know, you allow your women to actually do this? And they were all for that. And we built it together. Our motto at Amani Collective is, we're not just better together, we are our best. And so in 2013, I sold everything, left a box at my mom's house, and I moved into the village with the first 16 women of our program, because I also wanted them to know that I was in it with them, that I wasn't coming from out of the village from a higher end, like part of the city and into the village every day, but I was living at the same playing ground or below even, you know, so that they could see and we could develop that mutual respect. So as they taught me how to cook over an open fire or wash my clothes by hand, I taught them to sew. And it was this, again, mutual respect and relationship from the very beginning.
Beautiful. Well, let's talk about the sewing part. That's, you know, very interesting that you chose to teach them how to sew. Tell me a little bit about your own personal background. Was like, my mom taught me how to sew. So when I was a kid, and she loved to sew, it was not my favorite thing, but so where did the sewing piece come for you?
Yeah. So I was taught by my grandmother. It was a beautiful trade that she passed on, and I knew very basic sewing. So the first thing coming into this with them is I knew that I couldn't teach them everything. And I knew that from the very beginning, I wanted to partner always with the local community. And so I found a very dedicated and master seamstress to come alongside me from the very beginning, because I never wanted to be the bottleneck in the success of what we were doing, that if anything were to happen to me, that it would still continue on. And so Florence was my first teacher with me and helped me teach. So again, I was not an expert by any means, but I knew that if we could teach a skill, specifically sewing, right? It's so powerful in the sense of school uniforms need to be made, that they could potentially start that, or by helping their, by doing repairs or, you know, on their own outfits or whatever it might be, that it would be a skill that they could then utilize. But in the very beginning of starting that program, what I realized, or what I did not realize walking into, is that most of these women had never stepped foot inside of a classroom. So we had to start from the very beginning of teaching numbers to read your measuring tape, teaching letters to even, you know, potentially get to a point to where you could write your name. And it is so beautiful to see when you teach someone basic skills like that, how their self-efficacy and their confidence grows, because all of a sudden they can fill out forms or they can start doing that. Like, it was so much more than sewing. And I never realized that until I, you know, stepped foot and started building it with them.
Beautiful. So in the years leading up to 2013, you were just going over to visit, or were you living there as well?
Yeah.
And what were you doing that prepared you to make the decision to immerse yourself in that culture and in that community? Like, what were you doing to prepare yourself skill-wise, as well as mentally, emotionally, for sure, spiritually?
For sure. So my excuse was always school. I was finishing my undergrad and then my master's, and I got my master's in leadership education development. So it's just heartbeat of mine to develop leaders. And then I went on to get my doctorate in leadership education focused on social enterprises and entrepreneurs. But so that's what I was doing. That was my excuse of not moving ever, was, okay, I'm just going to come in the summers and finish school. And I think God has a really creative way of, again, your life. But I basically was like, I'm never moving. Like, this will never happen. I'm going to find a way to do it in the States and lead from afar. And one of my biggest advice that I give to anyone I'm coaching is, if you're going to start something, like, immerse yourself with that community and find, again, an opinion leader, find someone that you can build a relationship with, because you all, like, could go into all of that. But I think understanding the immersive nature of how we started to where we are now has completely developed the culture of who we are, which I did not have a strategic plan in the beginning of, like, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. I just knew in my gut that I needed to do this. But when I decided to move, I had three more classes I needed to take for my master's. And my excuse was, again, I always have to be in the classroom. And I, at that time, there wasn't a lot of online options. Like, I mean, you know, the pandemic completely changed a lot of that for students these days, but there wasn't a lot of online options. And I went to the dean of our college and was like, okay, I want to go to Kenya, but I have these three classes. And I wanted them to say no. Like, I wanted them, because I wanted them to tell me I couldn't move. And they said, oh, well, that's awesome, because all of those are available online and we can work around you and we can support you. And I was like, okay, great. So now I have to, now I have no excuses. So really, I think I was still kind of pushed. Like, I still, throughout my journey, I kind of went kicking and screaming. But I will say, our bodies are so smart, right? They tell us so much. And every time that I would land in Kenya, and the smell and the kind of stepping off of that plane, and I would land in Mombasa, it was, I knew I needed to be there. There are people that, especially my mom or other people in my life, are like, we knew you were going to move there many years before you ever did, because it took me a while to accept that. But I had, I would always have this peace that ultimately resonated in my body every time I was there. And although it maybe didn't make sense financially, or didn't make sense that fit into the square box, right, that people say our journey needs to go into, it felt right. And so that was ultimately the decision that got me there, is that feeling and following it through.
Beautiful. Well, Wickedly Smart Women, we're going to take a break right now. We could use your help. If you're enjoying this show, please consider joining our community, making a donation at wickedlysmartwomen.com, and sharing with your lovely lady friends that might benefit from our content. Help a gal out and let your sisters, mothers, daughters, friends, and colleagues know about the show so that we can serve them too. I want to say a huge thank you to all of our listeners who are downloading, rating, and reviewing from all around the world. We're welcoming thousands of downloads, and we're going to shout out this week to our listeners. We got to have Kenya in here somewhere. Let me see. We're going to shout out this week to our listeners. I'm going to find the places that are closest. Tanzania, and I think I do have Kenya on here. Yep, Kenya, and let's do Romania. Let's throw in Romania. And we will be right back with Dr. Jenny Nuccio.
The Wickedly Smart Women podcast is brought to you by the Wealthy Life Mentor. Women, are you on the edge knowing that life is calling you to make a change? Are you ready to be part of the evolution of what it means to be a wickedly smart woman, creating your wealthy life by design? A life that is an extraordinary work of art. Angel B. Hartwell, the Wealthy Life Mentor, is hired by women in transition. Women just like you who want to break through to their brilliance, become clear on the value of their wisdom, and embody a beauty-filled, balanced life of shameless self-expression. Discover your wealthy life readiness by taking the quiz at quiz.wealthylifementor.com.
And we are back with Dr. Jenny Nuccio. You can find out more about her and her Mani Collective and all of the other things that she's got going on, including her Moxie podcast, at jennynuccio.com. We will have that for you in the show notes. So before we went to the break, Jenny, you were talking about making that decision based on the feeling, based on the feeling. And so I really want our listeners to hear that you can create amazing, amazing impact in the most unusual of ways and way outside of the box of what you might have been conditioned or socialized to believe was possible for you by following your feeling. So, Jenny, talk to us about what is the experience of the Mani Collective and who you are now today. Like, how have you grown since you made that decision 13 years ago to move to Kenya?
Yeah, I think I'm like, wow. I mean, we could go in so many ways, but to sum it up, I would say I was always scared to, for the longest time, I felt misunderstood in what I was trying to do, because especially when you look at where we are now. So we are a global social enterprise. We are a holding company of multiple brands. We support well over 150 artisans on the coast in Kenya, as well in Northern Kenya and Turkana. We took artisan made, slow made, and made it elevated as well as at scale. So a lot of people think handmade can't be at scale, but we can do it in a very ethical manner and still output 15 to 20,000 units a month if we need to, you know, and we have very skilled people. And one thing also that I committed to was always providing monthly dignified work. So monthly salaries in the artisan space, you know, they get paid a lot of piecework, or cooperatives get really the last end of the stick because there's a middleman in between. And I never wanted that to be the case. I wanted our artisans to be able to plan, to be able to have financial training, to be able to put their kids in college. And with that, you need consistency and you need something that they can depend on. And so that's always been our driver there. But in all of that, in this blend of doing impact and doing business really well, from the very beginning, when I would ask, like, go and raise capital or do anything for a Mani Collective, there would always be like, well, are you a nonprofit or are you a business? And to me, there's a beautiful blend of both. It's not, do you have a business mindset or a nonprofit mindset? Do you have a sustainable mindset? You know, and what is that in the long term? And so always felt misunderstood. And that would really, really, it used to really, really bother me. And then a couple years ago, I realized that being misunderstood was my biggest superpower. It was my secret sauce of what we were trying to do. And so that feeling is that wild feeling. And my family, they still to this day will be like, she's the wild one, right? All my family's still in Texas. I'm the one that went out, right? She's just the wild one. And I always saw that as a negative connotation. Oh man, wild. Like, that's bad. Like, I just, again, I miss all the family gatherings. I miss all this. I'm just that wild one. And when I realized that being misunderstood was my superpower, I realized that wild was also, it's not negative. It's nothing to that. It's actually, it's this beautiful place where you know what you were innately made to be. And when you can release that wild and you can live in that wild and let it be wild, then you are doing the best service to the world and the people around you, because you are radiating everything that you were meant to be. And so I think in my journey, and self-discovery really, and also my living by my values and really just, you know, paving a way for the ethical space and world, it's like truly knowing that it's okay to be different, right? It's okay to be misunderstood, mm-hmm. because it's something that is a little bit, it's new and you're the one doing it. And we were made to do really big things in this world. And I think sometimes the world, again, puts us in a box and we live in that box. But if we were able to get out of it, to push into our wild, like, man, the world would be a better place altogether.
Beautiful. I love that. And, you know, all of that vast potential that's repressed, depressed, and suppressed being unleashed could certainly make a huge difference in the world. I'm curious, because I feel like my listeners may also be curious about how you are compensated. How do you get compensated as the, you know, founder of a social enterprise and nonprofit? You know, obviously, when you've first were over there, you probably didn't need a whole lot of compensation because you were learning how to wash your clothes in the river and all the other things that were part of your wilding, you know, part of your wilding, right? And I'm not saying that in a joking way. I really authentically want people to understand what you're talking about when you're talking about wilding. It really is about getting back to our inherent core nature. And there's nothing more core to our nature than being on the land.
Right.
Right. So let's talk about compensation.
Yeah. So yeah, when I started, I lived off about $200 a month, ate a lot of cassava plants and lived off very little. And I think as founder CEO, right, you always, especially as founder, you will always take the biggest sacrifice. So there was many, many years that I felt I don't need to be on payroll. I had a great mentor come to me and was like, probably 2016, I don't know, around that time, but asked me, was like, okay, if someone were to come in and replace you, like, how much would you pay them? And it was that concept of me never really thinking about money, right? Now, the funny part about this is I fight for people's pay, like paychecks. I fight that people get paid well. And someone posed the question to me, it was like, that's very interesting that you fight for people to get consistent payroll, fight for people to live above their means and raise to self-actualization. And you're over here not doing that for yourself. Mm-hmm. And this was a good probably 4 or 5 years ago where I started to wrestle with the idea of money. I think when you start in a nonprofit mindset space, that's really hard to deal with. Mm-hmm. And you have to cross over to what is wealth for good and for impact, right? As well, because the more we can make, the more generous we can be. So now, as we moved into that hybrid model, one of my actual motivations for moving into the hybrid model and making sure that when we did that in 2021, I said by 2026, we'll be a fully sustainable model, meaning that if we did not raise $1 in a donation, that we would be okay because our sales revenue alone would be able to take care of all the holistic programs we offer, from food to free childcare to health benefits and all of that. And with that, you know, we're still on track to meet that goal. And it's been really, really powerful for me to see, because now our nonprofit can do more outreach and growth and expansion versus just, you know, helping with the maintenance. And we're growing a business that's successful in that. So I was very timid at first, but I finally put myself on payroll. So I do get paid.
Great.
We do get paid through our business, as well as, yeah, I have a joy of coaching and doing other things that help my family as well. But I think that was my biggest question with that is like, what's my legacy for my family too? Where, you know, what are we leaving? At the end of the day, if I, after 40 years, let's say I left the nonprofit, it would be a beautiful impact that happened, but what would happen for my family too? So, and those are questions I pose to our artisans every day. I just started asking myself that, and it became an uncomfortable and different conversation when you pose yourself those questions, but I've been so grateful for just community and mentors that have come around me and like, you know, like we're going to talk in and speak into you what you do for others and you deserve to be in that space. So yeah, really mindful of where it goes and what we're doing, but happy to say that I've officially put myself on payroll.
Excellent. I'm going to ring my bell for that. You know, I think that this is something that I teach when I'm working with my people, I consult with my people, is you cannot continue to empty your cup and have anything that you're creating be actually sustainable. You can only serve, I like to tell them that, you know, and I think Lisa Nichols might have been the place where this quote originally came from, but it could have been from somebody else before her, is you need to be serving from the saucer. meaning your cup has got to be full and you're serving from the overflow rather than serving out of yourself. You're serving from the overflow. And so
I love that.
I really appreciate that you have chosen. And for women, especially, this is a hard thing. It is a hard thing. And what I want everyone who's listening to hear is we need to normalize this, normalize for every part of our lives, for wherever we're making impact, that we have to have our cup full first and serve from the overflow. There is 1 minute left, Jenny. So in the last minute, what would you like to have our listeners hear?
To be honest, to continue, if I were going to leave you with one last thing to live by, that's what I normally say on my podcast, would be to go out and to find out what your wild is and really dig deep. And go after it, to not be afraid of how that's defined by others, because you have the words for that definition of what your life should be. And I would encourage you to explore that. And with your whole body, pay attention to your body and how you feel. And the more effort it is, pull away from that and find the things that bring you ease and joy and light and really walk into that.
Oh, I love that. Ease, joy, light. Walk into that. That is the feminine way. I invite everyone to stop being seduced by the culture of busy and hard.
So true.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Jenny. What an inspiration you are. Listeners, we do love feedback. Please let us know what you thought of today's episode. Go right now to wickedlysmartwomen.com to join our community, share your takeaways, ask questions, or submit guest suggestions. Thank you so much for tuning in. Keep your ears open and remember, you are a wonderful woman.
Thanks for tuning in, downloading, and listening. Be sure to rate and review Wickedly Smart Women on Apple Podcasts and share with other women who can benefit from today's episode. Wickedly Smart Women is the premier podcast series for informing, activating, and inspiring the leader who carries profound wisdom and knows that now is the time to welcome wealth. We welcome your feedback and guest suggestions and invite you to subscribe to our mailing list to be notified of each new episode at wickedlysmartwomen.com.